Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. The final part of our Q&A with NPR's Ron Elving is about to begin. Elving visited Fort Wayne last month and spoke on the question, how deep is our commitment to democracy? The Q&A portion of his lecture will continue in a moment with a question about NPR's coverage of white nationalists and the idea of hearing from every point of view possible. Thank you for listening.
I'm Mark Perry. As you, I'm sure, are aware, a couple weeks ago when there was the white nationalist rally in D.C., NPR received a great deal of criticism because of interviewing the head of the organization.
Richard Spencer.
Yeah, so your idea of everybody giving voice is going to be messy, and perhaps you would care to talk a little bit about, is there at any point there should be a voice that whose ideas are so repugnant that they should not be heard?
Yes. To answer the last part of your question, immediately, yes, I do think that there are words we will not use on the air and we will not allow other people to use on our air because of the effect that they have on people and because they have no constructive use other than to have that effect on people. And we have an entire editor who is actually a remarkable man named Mark Memmott, whose title is Editor of Standards and Practices. And he is one of the most thoughtful people and one of the best journalists I've ever worked with, and I've worked with him for more than 20 years. He's one of the most thoughtful people I know, and he really genuinely tries to sort these questions out. There's no satisfactory answer to people who just want to come on your air and spew hate. And we don't let people just come on and have a five-minute segment to talk any more than virtually any other news organization other than C-SPAN. And I don't mean to criticize C-SPAN. In a sense, they're not really, strictly speaking, a news organization. They see themselves a little differently. And they believe in presenting things in the raw with the same obvious caveats about certain kinds of terminology and so on. But they let people talk pretty much whatever they want to say. And the hosts, thank you for your call. Next caller on the independent line. I love the lines and the, you know, who's an independent and who's not. That's an experiment, too. It's an experiment, too, and I think it serves a real function. But I think if you're going to call yourself a news organization, you need somebody who will say, wait a minute, what do you mean? And part of the problem with that interview was that the host was struggling to, but not necessarily entirely succeeding in corralling this personality who was using his opportunity to talk to such a large audience to, you know, be himself. That's a real problem. There's no, as you say, messy. There's no way of cleaning it all up. It's going to be messy. But I think that's an illustration of how far we're prepared to go in illustrating this 360 idea. We really do want to. Now, people say, we never have Donald Trump on. That is not for lack of trying. We have tried on a virtually daily basis to interview the president since the summer of 2015. And while we have had presidents who were more eager to be on our air than others, we've never had one who just basically doesn't respond. So that can be for whatever reason. That's never been entirely explained to us. He's not a big radio guy. Let's start with that. He's not a big radio guy. He understands, you know, the newspaper industry, and he watches television maybe 6 to 10 hours a day. Yeah. So when you have somebody who is that far into that world, his notion of NPR is probably that we're the people with the middle seat in the second row of the White House briefing room, or Mara Liasson, or somebody else that he sees on Fox. He is not, in all likelihood, a listener. But we try. And we certainly have his spokespersons on every day. And when you say 360, you know, you're talking about the full circle, and you really do need to live by that. It's not going to all be equally represented. But if you want to be the place where the conversation happens, you have to let everybody in the door.
I'm Pat Meyer. I'm old enough to remember when politics was a civil discourse. What do you think it's going to take to get us back? And I'm not necessarily meaning back to Eisenhower, although I could remember politics in that era, but to get us back to the point where somebody crossing the aisle is not automatically railed against by their own part by their own party.
Mm. Well, some of this. Thank you very much for that question. I hope everyone could hear about civility. There are kind of two issues here. One of them is language and demeanor and manners. Another is bipartisanship or crossing the aisle, as you say. And this is a good moment to pause and pay my respects to John McCain, who somebody that I covered some. And I have great memories of him, particularly at the 1996 Republican convention in San Diego, where he went down every day to the lobby of the media hotel, not his hotel, wearing a polo shirt, and hung out. Now, he was doing that on behalf of Bob Dole, who was the nominee that year, and saying wonderful things about Bob Dole and kidding with the journalists and just sort of being a personality and being the charming John McCain. He was also launching the 2000 John McCain presidential campaign. And we all understood that. He was very good at crossing the aisle. In years past, I was a Senate staffer in the 1980s. In those years, the inside joke was that the worst relationship in the Senate was between two senators from the same state in the same party. We have some Ohioans here, I'm sure. Howard Metzenbaum and John Glenn. Yeah, that was not a civil relationship. And the best relationships were between people of different parties in different states, but had shared interests. And that was so often the case. It was so often borne out. You saw it again and again and again. Also, small sort of side issue that's really very important. In those days, senators and congressmen moved to Washington, had a home there, rented or bought a home, oftentimes sent their kids to school there. That does not happen anymore. That just does not happen. Because if you do that, you've gone, you know, you've got Potomac fever. You've left the people at home behind. And our transportation is so good. Even the Californians, even some of the Hawaiians and Alaskans go home several times a month. Seriously. And they don't bring their families, and they stay only three nights a week. And that means they don't have any time to socialize with each other or have any kind of shared human experiences with each other or have that extraordinary thing that so many of us have, which is the bonds we've made with people through our kids. That does not exist anymore, and it used to be one of the main personal bonds, one of the main personal interchanges between members of Congress. And McCain was a perfect example of somebody who naturally was hugely gregarious. Before he was in Congress, he was the Navy's liaison to the Senate. And the building that some people are talking about naming for him, I don't think it's going to happen, but the building they're talking about naming for him, the Russell Building, he worked there as a staff member in the 70s, you know, wearing his Navy uniform and talking to people about Navy stuff, but also just talking to people about everything, because that was John McCain. So he had relationships with senators from when he was in the Navy. And then he became a congressman, then he became a senator, and he was always somebody that was, you know, kind of a free radical in chemical terms. I mean, he was just out there thinking and doing and talking and sometimes getting in trouble. But he was very human and enormously open. God, we're going to miss him. I just can't say how much. I mean, of course, he's been gone really for a year already. But we are going to miss him and that kind of personality because it has really become much more hardline partisan. There is less civility. Not even so much. I mean, the language, you know, if you ever get a chance to either listen to Hamilton or see the actual production of it, one of the things they get right is how nasty people were to each other back in the revolutionary days. The founding fathers largely couldn't stand each other, and, you know, they said horrible things about each other. But they did the job. They worked together. They made the compromises. They sat down. They worked out impossible problems. Impossible problems. And they got the country going. And eventually, although it took most of a century, they addressed the biggest question that divided them, which was slavery. And it took a long, long time. But that eventually got done. And if that could get done, and if progress can be made in other ways, the way this country has always done, then I think we have something special going on here. And I think we can rejuvenate that something special. And I think we can recapture some of the exceptionalism. I'll embrace that word that we have been given by our enormous good fortune as a country.
My name is Bernie Wiebe.
Hey, Bernie.
And so there's a the puzzle I've been trying to figure out. When we talk about the 360, there's a segment of that pie puzzles me, which is the evangelicals who are such a huge part of Trump's loyal base. Mm-hmm. And I can't get my mind around it. I wonder if you have any insights.
Oh, my. I should begin by telling you that I am the son and grandson of evangelical ministers. So I can't address that question anything but personally. My father lived to be almost 100 and died just as Donald Trump was emerging. And I cannot imagine a person less like my father than Donald Trump. But he lived in a retirement community where I don't think any of the television equipment actually could receive more than one television channel. And so he was certainly well aware of how much of an outlier he was and how much enthusiasm there was for him in his retirement community based in his denomination. Of course, you're all familiar with the Swedish Evangelical Mission Covenant Church of America. Actually, there is one not too terribly far from here. And they were very enthusiastic about Donald Trump. They did not think that Donald Trump, as one person put it, a saint or a person that I would necessarily want to marry. But their sense of anger about this sense they had that the rest of the culture was excluding them, disrespecting them, not listening to them, and the sense that they got from the choice of Mike Pence, and the sense they got from many of the things that Donald Trump was willing to say and commit to, including the appointment of people to the Supreme Court who, while they won't necessarily say so, would seem to be the kind of people who would be inclined to change the law on abortion in America, an enormously important issue to not just evangelicals, but to most evangelicals. And there are a number of others as well. It's what you might, back in the Bill Clinton days, we talked about compartmentalization, where Bill Clinton seemed to be able to operate in very different compartments, and people seemed to be able to forgive him for things because they liked other things about him. I think there's a comparison to be made there, and I do think a lot of evangelical voters would have preferred maybe Ted Cruz, maybe Mike Pence himself, would have preferred Mike Huckabee or Rick Santorum, other people who would be much more simpatico with their worldview and their lifestyle, their personal choices. But given that Donald Trump won, and even before he had the nomination, there was an appeal about his disruptiveness, there was an appeal about the people who opposed him, were the people that they themselves opposed, you know, the enemy of my, well, you know how that works, enemy of my enemy. I don't want to get that mixed up, but you know what I'm saying. That somebody who is that upsetting to certain personalities in the media had to be somebody worth taking a good look at. So I have spent a great deal of time on this question. I have wrestled with it, and I don't have any simple answers, except to say that I believe when you ask somebody, how do you feel about Donald Trump? Do you approve of his performance as president? People oftentimes answer a different question. They feel that the question is as much about them as they feel it's about Donald Trump. And they know the sense in which they feel a personal tie to how well he does. And they may have real problems with some of the things they're hearing about Donald Trump, believable or not, but they know that they don't want yet to break that connection that made them feel as though the right thing happened in 2016. You know, a simple version of that is when people hear the question, do you approve of Donald Trump? They might be hearing the question, do you regret having voted for Donald Trump? Or do you wish that Hillary Clinton were president? That's an easier question for them to answer. And people tend to answer the easiest form of the question they can create out of the question that was asked. There's even a term for that in reasoning. I forget what it is, but answering a different question because it's an easier question to answer. And I think we all do that. And any question would be easier for me to answer than that one. But thank you. I appreciate the question.
Thank you, Sally Eddington. The group of voters that you alluded to earlier that swung from Obama to Trump, what do you think either of the parties with all the factions within them would need to do to get that group back?
I could make a great deal of money if I had a perfect answer to that question. No one really knows. A great deal of polling is going into trying to answer that question. One of the best things I've seen on the question was done by a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel named Craig Gilbert. And he studied all the county results from Wisconsin. There were 14 adjacent counties in north central Wisconsin. Some of you may know something about that state. 14 counties, just about two-thirds of the way up in the state, that had voted twice for Obama and went for Trump. 14 counties. And by the way, it wasn't close. They voted pretty strongly for Obama and pretty strongly for Trump. So clearly, we'd have to start out by saying they were not Hillary Clinton fans, and that was, you know, understandable. And pretty clearly that they were not attracted to whatever they saw in Mitt Romney, because most of them are more generally Republican voters. They vote for Scott Walker, they vote for Republicans for other offices. But they liked something that was different, and I'll use the word disruptive, about Barack Obama. He was outside the usual notion of what Washington was about. And I think oftentimes, and at least people that I talked to in Wisconsin, in that same part of the state back in 2008, were kind of proud to tell you they were going to vote for Barack Obama because they thought it was saying something about themselves that they liked. You know, clearly they didn't get pried off of that by either Romney or Obamacare or any other big factor in 2012. But over the length of the 8 years, as many American independent voters, swing voters, do, they gravitated away from the party that they had just voted for last. And there is an extraordinarily consistent pattern in American voting that we, generally speaking, give a president a second term, and we, generally speaking, give the White House to the other party after that second term. Very few breaks. Very few breaks. FDR, obviously, an exception to everything. And then there was George H.W. Bush in 1988. But that's it. Apart from that, we really kind of like that 8-year swing. There have been other, you know, there have been other exceptions, but generally speaking, we observe that 8-year thing, and I think that's not accidental. I think that swing voters have a tendency to gravitate away from their last decision, see a certain amount of dissatisfaction with the party in power, and buy into much of the criticism that comes from the other party. So that's one kind of explanation for it. I think it's really hard to reach a facile conclusion about people's sexism or racism or things on the basis of one vote. We'll see if over the long haul those factors seem to have risen again from where they were. We'll see. There is real resistance in some parts of the United States to women candidates. We've seen that in both parties, and we've seen it in elections. There's a reason that we're in the low 20s of women in the Senate. But consider this. When I worked in the Senate in the 1980s, there was no women's restroom for senators. There was no women's restroom for senators because there were only two or three. And they had never thought to put one in the first place. So that's a little bit of change. When my mother was born, women couldn't vote in the United States. That's kind of hard to believe, isn't it? Isn't that hard to believe? So where we are today is not where we began. We have covered some distance. Maybe in Francis Fukuyama's kind of example, we went a long way in a fairly short period of time, and the natural thing that happens after that is a bit of a swing back, a bit of a pushback. But then the same physics, if you believe that physics apply to human issues and concerns, the same physics would take us back in the other direction. Or if you want to be more idealistic about it than that, Martin Luther King's quotation, "The arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice." And I still believe that.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. Let's have a big hand for Ryan Alvin.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. This entire episode can be found online at WBOI.org. Special thanks to Sweetwater Sound for providing the audio for this program, and our music is by Mark Waldick. The lecture portion of Ron Elving's presentation is also available at WBOI.org. Thank you so much for listening to WBOI Presents, a program that is made possible through your support. Folktales is next. Have a wonderful night.